Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Beth Malden, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Andrew Sobenet, who is an associate professor in the Department of French and Francophone Studies at Georgetown University. His new book is Generation Stalin, French Writers, the Fatherland, and the Cult of Personality. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this topic?
So yeah, I'd be happy to. So, and I'm delighted to be here. So thank you again. So I am I'm a French studies scholar. I did my PhD in French literature, but I've always had an interest in the ways in which literature expresses politics. And this is going back to my undergraduate years. Back to my senior honors thesis. And my first book was on prison narratives. And one of the reasons I enjoyed doing that topic so much was that it allowed me to look at not only the form of the narratives, but also the ways in which they expressed various sociopolitical viewpoints and could be used as a springboard to study history and things like that. So, and alongside that project, that first book project, I did a lot of work on the Vichy period, so 1940 to 1944 in France, and slowly became more and more interested in the mid century. Just because of the turbulence, the big ideological clashes of the mid century really fascinate me. And so after I finished my first book and decided I wanted to move on from Vichy because there's been so much scholarship done, and I reference this in Generation Stalin, so much very good scholarship done on, and I'm, you know, on the Vichy era, that I wanted to try to do something that was a little bit different. And so I initially was going to do a book on extremism, more broadly speaking. This was back in 2009 when I was exploring topics. And you can see how long it took me to get this out. and so I decided to start by looking at the extreme left, since I knew the extreme right so well from all the work on Vichy. And as I thought I knew something about the French Communist Party, but it turns out that I knew extremely little about the French Communist Party. So as I was poking around, you know, there are many, many good histories of the PCF and a couple of now old but very good histories of French intellectuals in the PCF, David Cott being the best one, or among the best ones, from 1964. I discovered that, for me, it was a discovery that the very first official biography of Stalin was written by Henri Barbusse, who I knew because of Le Feu, who's more widely known for his work as an anti-war writer. That was his documentary novel of the trenches, more or less, that won the Prix Goncourt in 1916. And so the fact that I had never heard of this book, the fact that a French novelist was selected to write the first biography, I found that just endlessly interesting. And the more and more I dug around, the more I saw that indeed that there hadn't been a lot of coverage of Stalinism, specifically speaking, in all the scholarship done on the history of French intellectuals with the party. So that was the initial step in getting into it. So it was kind of a circuitous path, but one that I'm I'm very glad that I discovered and that I'm going to continue on, and we can talk about that later for my next project. But I have the feeling that I'm not done with the Communist Party yet. So.
Okay, great. Well, let's jump into your book. As you said, the first official biography of Joseph Stalin was written by the French novelist Henri Barbusse, who is known for his novel Le Feu.
Right.
Could you give us a little background on Barbusse and the mm-hmm. intellectual path that led him to write this biography, beginning with his experience in World War I?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, and it's one of the things that's so fascinating about Barbusse and about many of these people, the ways, that was one of the things that I find interesting is sort of the ways how people end up getting to Stalinism. And they all had very different paths, but interestingly enough, each of these people that I focus on in the book were profoundly touched by the First World War in various ways. So for Barbusse, he enlisted, sort of out of this desire to contribute to the war effort. This was the war that was going to end all wars, the war that was going to bring social justice, the war that would lead to equality, and the war that would put an end to oligarchy and the crown, the et cetera, et cetera. So he enlisted in 1914 as a 41-year-old man, which is, old at any time to join the infantry. And he gets injured and he ends up as a convalescent, begins to write his anti-war novel, Le Feu. And so he goes from having a socialist, but he never joined the Socialist Party, by the way, which is an interesting fact. But he goes from having a socialist and patriotic viewpoint on the war. In other words, he wants to fight as both as a human and as a Frenchman, is how he describes it, to being completely against the war and thinking that the only way, and this takes him some time to get to, he references this at the end of Le Feu, that there could be a revolution coming that's bigger than the war itself that could sort of lead to the results that they had hoped for from the war, which is to bring, like I said, equality and justice. But slowly after, so he publishes Le Feu in 1916. It gets a huge amount of attention. It wins the Goncourt. It becomes one of the most widely read novels in the first decades of the 20th century. It gets partially censored in France and banned in Germany. But for many years after its publication, the fundamental ideas in Le Feu were recirculated throughout the communist press. And so then Barbusse became a hero for many, many people because of this book. I mean, Einstein had a picture of Barbusse on his workstation next to a portrait of his deceased mother. Lenin read the book and referenced it in his writing. So it was a major work. After, in the immediate post-war period, the thing that's interesting with Barbusse and also Romain Rolland, they go through Wilsonian phases, in part because of the 14 points and the ideals that some of the American ideals, which we still aspire to today, towards, democracy and freedom of peoples and things like that. But by 1919, he becomes completely disillusioned with Wilson and then turns toward what he calls the North and the Great Revolution there and becomes fascinated with Lenin. And then by 1923, he officially joins the PCF.
Right. So Barbusse was a big proponent of Wilson's vision of internationalism, and he thought that the League of Nations was the best means of continuing the legacy of 1789.
Yeah.
And so he initially praised the French Revolution and denounced the Russian Revolution. But as you just said, that attitude changed. What happened?
So that's a good point, and thank you for interjecting that detail. So indeed, he became extremely disillusioned with Western democracy as a whole, and began to think that the French Republic was hollow, that the ideals of the revolution had never been fully attained, and that there was no way to find to achieve the ideals that Barbusse aspired to through Western liberal democracy, and so. As news of the other great revolution, meaning the one in the Bolshevik Revolution, begins to spread throughout Europe, Barbusse becomes more and more enchanted with it, and he begins to refer to then Russia, it wasn't the Soviet Union at that point yet, as his patrie, his fatherland. He was initially critical of the Bolsheviks. He called it a murderous split. And he was critical of what he called their dictatorial measures. But then he began to sort of adopt the the very, and this is a perspective that he had, and then you could argue that he had this with the First World War as well, that the end justified the means. In other words, that whatever, it didn't matter how you got there, as long as you got to the end, which was, you know, justice and equality, you could be as violent as you wanted. And so that's a Leninist notion that goes back to the Jacobins, but for Barbusse at this point, it was fundamentally Leninist.
Okay. So then in 1927, Barbusse makes his first trip to the Soviet Union, or was it known as the Soviet Union in 27?
Yes, after 22. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So he makes his first trip to the USSR, which was the 10th anniversary of the October Revolution in 1927. Can you describe that trip for us?
Yes. So he this is one in a series of many, many, many Potemkin visits. And this wasn't just for Barbusse. And so it's the notion of a Potemkin village. In other words, that the decors that they set up for the visitors are not at all representative of reality. And so he goes to the Soviet Union in 1927 for the 10th anniversary of October. And it's a hero's welcome. And he had a number of goals for making this trip, one of which was to help him with the with his various publications and to get his books translated into Russian. And so it was a way of solidifying his integration into the party sphere, but also a way to promote himself as a writer. So it was on that first visit that he first met Stalin. And it was a fundamentally important moment for Barbusse and for many others. That was a moment of great public outreach, that the 10th anniversary of the October Revolution. And it was very well documented in L'Humanité, which was the daily newspaper of the French Communist Party, which I used was one of my favorite, and I became kind of addicted to reading it. My favorite resources I got addicted to the whole party media, and we can talk about that later if you want. But there's so much to find, and there's so much digitized by Gallica, by the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, that it's just so readily accessible and so just endlessly interesting to me. But so it was widely documented, and it's fascinating to read the various testimonies. And he bumped into Victor Serge, who was somebody that I worked on in my first book, who was a left oppositionist, who was a Trotskyist, who was persecuted by Stalin. And this is before Serge was put into internal exile in the Soviet Union. And Serge brought up to Barbusse, you know, the fact that that the revolution wasn't really being loyal to its ideals. And Barbusse sort of pretended not to hear him. Mm-hmm. Clearly wasn't interested in getting all the facts.
I have questions for you about that later, about the blind eye that he turned to, the truth of what was going on there. But in these Potemkin visits are fascinating to me. What exactly was he shown?
So Barbusse was, okay, so he, it's interesting because he ends up doing what one would call research, I guess, but that was extremely limited to what the government was telling him. So he would get this is before the Stalin biography. He wrote a couple of books that are just chock full, one in particular is really, really unreadable. It's called Voici ce qu'on a fait de la Géorgie, what they have made out of Georgia, Soviet Georgia. And it's, you know, it's never been translated into English, and for good reason. It's just not a readable book. But it's, he tries to document the ways in which the magical ways in which the Soviet Union has been transformed into this utopia where all races but one have been erased. You know, this is the Soviet race, and he compares it. It's like a better version of America, and that there was this homogenizing force, like Americanization, but it's Sovietization, but it's better because it's not exploitative, and it gets rid of religion, and the government is determined to respect all nationalities while making everyone Soviet. That was one of the paradoxes of that. Of that policy. So he, you know, the example that I use in the book is that he, rather than talk to prisoners, he talked to the jailers. I mean, gives it to you in a nutshell. It's very limited primary sources. And he was very much criticized for this in outside the party press, because there was a high degree of polarization in the 20s and 30s in the French press, and the French Communist Party affiliate and official organs were at one clear left, far left pole. But yeah, so it's a way of only paying attention to what the government is telling him and not being curious for whatever reason about things that, you know, this blindness that could be motivated by finances. I always suspected that, and and also a desire for fame on the part of Barbusse. I left my study of Barbusse thinking that he was very much motivated by fame. And he, that was the, it's hard to, I don't have documentation that says that, but everything that I've looked at, I mean, I've read most of his work. I did a ton of research on him and how he wrote his books. And I just got the overriding impression that he was extremely concerned with his career and his publications and wanting to make a name for himself. And he had kind of a mini cult of personality on his own. There's film of him sort of hectoring a crowd in Moscow from the early 1930s. He's an interesting figure, not for the best reasons, unfortunately.
How did he actually come to write this official biography?
So that's an interesting question as well. That's a complex. It was a really complex history that went into him writing the book. So initially, the way that his secretary and I suspect his lover Annette Vidal, who traveled with him on all of his visits, described it was that, you know, he and Stalin were hanging around and the idea of this biography came up and Stalin pointed to Barbusse and there's the guy who needs to write. And so that is a completely apocryphal story, the way that it's told, in this. And it was Barbusse who proposed the idea to Stalin and that Stalin loved the idea, blah, blah, blah. So that's just not accurate. So the archival sources and historians have, there were many false starts. Stalin initially resisted attempts to write his biography. They sought out other writers to do it. They asked Gide to do it. They asked Gorky. They asked Lion Fuchtwanger, the German novelist and writer, and even Sergei Kirov, who had been assassinated, and Bulgakov as well, who had been made miserable by his contact with Stalin. And so it's a very fraught history, but they eventually settle on Barbusse in part because he could be relied upon for to do the work in the right way. And indeed, the documents that I found in the Russian archives were amazing to see what Barbusse got a hold of, what he was sent, how they told him what they weren't happy with, what they were happy with. It's clear that he listened and he was malleable, and he ends up writing the cornerstone of the Stalin of the personality cult around Stalin.
Right. How did it contribute to the creation of that cult of personality?
So in part because of the way the Soviet and the Russian and well the Soviet and the French, as you say, just the broader common term, the way information traveled in the common term. Broadly speaking, because there was this constant cycle of reciprocal promotion of ideas and publications. So, and there's this way of constantly recycling ideas and ideological points, and especially around the characteristics of Stalin. So this was a text that became I argue, I don't have documentary proof, but based on my close readings of this text and the subsequent official biographies, I argue that it served as a prototype. I mean, it's just the parallels are unmistakable. And Barbusse's text was cited in a number of other French biographical statements on around Stalin. So it was, and it got huge promotion in the party press. It was timed to coincide, and this is another part of my argument, the Stalin cult in France was launched in around Stalin's 55th birthday, whereas so with the 5-year delay compared to the Soviet Union. So that there's consensus among historians that the Stalin cult was born in 1929 around Stalin's 50th birthday. And so there's a 5-year delay. So at the end of 1934, 1935, you have this massive promotion, not only of Stalin's birthday, but also about Barbusse's book. And so it just from then on, it just stayed. And Barbusse's reputation remained impeccable through the end of the Stalinist era. So basically, the early 50s in France. And he was seen as one of their founding fathers. And it's the thing that's interesting about that is that the Stalinist side of Barbusse's political commitment has slowly been eroded in memory and scholarship as well. And so he had become remembered as sort of a father of the French left because of Le Feu, but people just conveniently or not forgot about the Stalinist side. And that was one of the reasons I was so motivated to write this book, was to recalibrate not just Barbusse's, our understanding of Barbusse closer to the truth, but for Romain Rolland and Éluard. But, you know, Aragon was notorious before my book. So it's, so it wasn't as necessary with him. But with the other three, I think it was, you know, that's that I feel is one of the more one of the newer things that I bring to the conversation with this book.
In addition to writing Staline, Barbusse's political engagement served as a blueprint for communist aligned activity in France for a generation. How so?
So basically Barbusse, in terms of the way that he visited the Soviet Union, in terms of the way that he was integrated into the party media sphere, in terms of the way that he served as a figurehead, in terms of and his contact with Stalin as well, and I can't remember if I said that already, but his mode of engagement, in terms of as a writer, as a public intellectual, was imitated by first, and there was sort of this baton that was passed from Barbusse then to Romain Rolland, and then ultimately to Aragon, who became really central after Rolland. So Barbusse dies in 1935. Rolland more or less slips into the role that Barbusse had held that same year. And then after the war and Rolland's death in 1944, he died in December 1944, Aragon had attained a lot of prestige as a result of his, you know, his heroism, frankly, during the war. In the Second World War and the First, for that matter, and also his work and his clandestine work in the resistance. And so Aragon became the central writer, and indeed to the central French communist writer, to the point where he was a member of the Central Committee. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, we can talk about Aragon, but yeah, so Barbusse served as, was the paragon, and he served as a model for the rest of them. Consciously or not, I think consciously so, frankly.
Just to finish up with Barbusse, you write that Staline did not enjoy a long shelf life in the Soviet Union.
No, it did not. Yeah, that's a very interesting story. So, and it's one of the things that is tricky about, it's this sort of Orwellian way of making people unpersons. And so Barbusse praised a number of figures in the biography. So it's published in 1935 in France, and then published serially in Russia in 36, and then as a book in 36 as well. And by the time it's, you know, very shortly after its release in Russia, so many of the people that Barbusse praised had become enemies of the people and had been executed and, you know, subject to all sorts of humiliations and show trials. And so they had to take it off the shelves. And so even in as late as 1948, for similar reasons, they wanted to translate it into the Kazakh language. And the head of the officials from the head of propaganda and agitation wrote that indeed they confirmed the same reasons why it didn't last in Russian and why it couldn't be translated. Barbusse often mentions and quotes enemies of the people, such as, you know, Bubnov, Radek, Rinko, Rykov, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's one of these things, and especially when you compare, and I was shocked when I looked at this. I had never seen, until I was doing the research for this, the transcripts of the show trials. I'd never really read them. And just the abject ways in which these people that had been held up as, you know, exemplary Bolsheviks and revolutionaries by Barbusse were then reduced to these abject and really just extremely sad confessions to try to save their lives and, you know, and to just to stay alive and try to remain loyal to the Soviet Union, and they were not successful.
So in your next chapter, you talk about Romain Rolland.
Uh-huh.
And you say that his path to integration in the Soviet orbit was longer and more complex,
right,
than that of Barbusse. Could you tell us a little bit about Rolland and then talk about his intellectual trajectory?
So, yeah. So Rolland is a very interesting figure. And again, like Barbusse, was a dominant figure in French intellectual life in the early part of the 20th century. And so he's widely known in the early part of the 20th century as for his first roman fleuve, which is, you know, roughly translated as a river novel, which is a multi-volume novel about one subject. And his first roman fleuve was published between 1904 and 1912. It was called Jean Christophe. And the main thrust of the book was sort of to advocating for this transnational harmony in Europe, especially between France and Germany, and sort of advocating for this a harmony. And this was one of the things that dominated Roland's thinking for many, many years, was this idea that you could have balance and harmony and peace among various different peoples, to use, I guess, the language of the time. And so by 1914, so he's living in Switzerland and he writes and he's against the war. And so at a highly nationalist moment, so this is early during the Battle of the Marne, the first Battle of the Marne in 1914, he writes an essay called Au-dessus de la mêlée, which translates as above the battle, which is translated as above the battle. And it's banned in France. They're not allowed to publish it in France. And it earns him, state censorship for the next year or so through, I think, the end of 1915. And he becomes known across Europe as an anti-war writer, as somebody who advocates for internationalism and peace, and somebody who sees the dangers of nationalism, the dangers of taking patriotic ideals and twisting them for power or for imperialism or for whatever reason. And after the war, he's somewhat of an activist during the war. He works with the Red Cross, helps political prisoners and things like that, and writes a number of very powerful essays, by the way, in the same phase, and manifestos and whatnot. So he's integrated. He's very much he's one of the extremely active public intellectuals at this time, just like Barbusse was, both of them sort of in the Zola mold, especially for Barbusse, whose hero was indeed Emile Zola. And one of the cliches around Barbusse is that he's the Zola of the trenches. And when I say that sort of in that way, because it just dismisses the whole Stalin side of his engagement. But anyway, so with Roland, he's not as seduced by, he's indeed resistant to, just like Barbusse was initially. He becomes appalled by what he sees in Russia, in terms of the dictatorial behavior, the budding police state, the methods of the Bolsheviks. And Barbusse was very much the opposite of Barbusse in that the means did not justify the end. Indeed, the means for Barbusse were more important than the end, because he thought the means had a more durable and lasting effect on the way a political body would function after that end was attained. So violence was not, at this phase in his career, and immediately after the war, violence was not seen as a viable option for Roland. And he indeed, and you could probably hear Gandhi in the background here, he indeed espoused Gandhian notions of non-resistance, non-violence, non-acceptation, ahimsa, is what they, the term that they use in India for that concept. And so Roland becomes the most prominent Western advocate for Gandhian ideals in the 1920s. And he writes a very important biography of Gandhi. It's published in 1924 based on some essays that he had previously published, and rejects the dictators of Moscow in that very book. And then in this same phase, actually earlier in the 1920s, before the publication of the Gandhi biography, Barbusse and Roland have a debate, a public debate, around the best ways of achieving revolutionary ideals or achieving equality or achieving whatever end they all agree on, that society needs to be better. Democracy has become stale. The West is no longer, functional. It's nationalist, it's imperialist, it's greedy, it's corrupt. And they disagree, like I said, on the question of violence and ends versus the means and how to get there. And it's an important debate, and that aspect of both of their histories has not been forgotten. That's widely known. But again, what happens later is, in most scholarship, becomes extremely vague with both of them. And that was one of the reasons I ended up following up on both of these two writers. And because they became both of them the most prominent, they were the first two most prominent intellectuals affiliated with the party. So the Gandhian phase for Roland lasts a very long time. It's a question of degree for him. And again, in 1927, Roland begins to become seduced by the ideals of the Soviet Union and this idea of Soviet exceptionalism, the idea that the USSR indeed is trying to achieve its ideals and indeed is a legitimate way of attaining peace. And this coincides with the rise of fascism in Italy and the fact that Roland is deeply disturbed by fascism, and then becomes increasingly, when Hitler comes to power, by then Roland is very much committed to, and indeed abandons his reservations around violence, thinking that, and they, something that he says in one of his texts is that it's individual conscientious objectors may save their souls, but, you know, he became convinced that armed military conflict was the only way to fight fascism and national socialism.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Yeah, it's such a stark turn from that Gandhian nonviolence to an embrace of Soviet authoritarianism.
Yeah,
you even have a quote where he said that the Soviet leaders had to dirty their hands. We have no right to act right. Like we are disgusted. Then you go on to say that the new principles that he adopted as part of this turnaround were fundamental to his play entitled Robespierre, which is what I would like to talk about next. And the play was written in 1939, when France was celebrating the sesquicentennial of the French Revolution. Could you talk about the context of that celebration in 1939?
Like you said, it's the sesquicentennial of 1789. So 150 years later, this is a history that I found. And when I had initially begun my investigation into Roland, I was going to study his second roman fleuve, which is called L'âme enchantée. In English, it translates as The Soul Enchanted. And this was published in the late 20s and the early 1930s. That shows, and the story that shows, this is just as a sidebar because I think it's interesting, before I get into Robespierre, and this is to explain how I got to Robespierre. In the late 20s and early 1930s, it shows basically the protagonist of this roman fleuve moves from sort of Gandhian ideals to a very deep sense of anti-fascism, somebody who's willing to tolerate the means of the Russian Revolution. So that multi-volume novel effectively tells the story of Roland's own transformation. So as I was digging around, I discovered that Roland wrote a series of plays on the revolution and that have not been widely studied, in part because they're not very, many of them are not very readable. They were never really put on stage or, you know, to any great extent. I mean, they all had some exposure, but nothing huge. And as I was just familiarizing myself with his career, looking at the archives, and I got to this, and I think it was through Humanité that I discovered, because I had no idea that there was this sesquicentennial celebration of the revolution. One hears about 1889 and 1989. And so the reason is because, you know, 1939 was the apogee of the gravest, you know, geopolitical crisis that Europe had seen in the 20th century. And so, and it indeed curtailed the celebrations around, literally, I mean, they ended up canceling some events around the celebration of the revolution. So there was not a lot of energy devoted to the celebration at the time. The most ambitious events were scuttled in favor of having, you know, several smaller events, you know, parades, and mainly parades, actually. And Roland, in preparation for this event, ends up writing a book that he had been intending to write for many years, to finish his series of plays on the revolution, because for a long time he considered Robespierre to be the greatest man of the French Revolution who had not received his historical due, and that was even before he became a Stalinist, Roland, and decides to write his play Robespierre. So it's the sequel to his Danton, but it happens to be written 40 years later. And so this play is written in for a 1930s, a late 1930s audience. So Renan tells the story of Robespierre through the lens of a philo-Soviet pro-Stalinist political viewpoint. And so Robespierre in many ways serves as a stand-in for Stalin, a man who sacrifices himself for the revolution, who puts the will of the people above all, who is pure in his revolutionary ideals, and whose determination to see those ideals realized leads him into problematic directions here and there. So he's able to reference the contradictions in Soviet communism, but at the same time justify them by saying that, you know, without Robespierre, the revolution is dead. And indeed, when Robespierre is guillotined at the end of the story, counter-revolutionaries take over, the revolution is put to an end, and the republic dies.
So looking at the historical figure of Robespierre, I've always been intrigued by him. He is fascinating and, of course, very polarizing. How is he generally understood by historians?
Well, like you said, it's a polarized interpretation of Robespierre. So according to many, according to the various perspectives of historians, Robespierre has been a malleable figure. So in the 19th century, when liberalism was more dominant in French historical circles, Danton was the great figure, and so which is reflected in official monuments. So there's the famous statue in Paris. Outside the movie theater where people meet. And that statue was erected in 1889, for the centennial of the revolution. But by the times, sort of socialist historiography begins to take off, in the early decades of the 20th century, then you have a rehabilitation of Robespierre that is done in what is known as the Mathiez school of thought, where Mathiez interpreted him as being unfairly demonized as a dictator. Mathiez was the founder in 1907 of the Société des Études Robespierristes, and an editor and a frequent contributor to the journal. And so he was writing against the mainstream view that Danton was the primary figure and hero of the revolution. And so Mathiez wanted to upend what he described as the anti-Robespierre legend, that he was responsible for the terror, that he was a dictator, that he was sent to the, and he wanted to point out that he was a victim of injustice, that he was sent to the guillotine with sans jugement, without adjudication. And Roland adopts the Mathiez point of view and has read Mathiez, references him in the afterword of the play, and makes it clear that he wants to rehabilitate the image of Robespierre.
Right. And so how does the play serve as a rehabilitation of Robespierre? And how is it a justification of Stalin's authoritarian rule? Because some literary critics read it a different way.
They do. The majority of critics read it as an anti-Stalinist play. And that's because the majority of Roland critics have been resistant to the idea and have obfuscated the idea that Roland indeed became a Stalinist. And so Roland's Stalinism is a little complicated because, and one has to recognize this, that he, in private, he expressed a number of reservations, not uniformly, but there were some reservations that he did express, but there were other times in private that he did say that in public he thought he was doing the right thing, but then we can get into that a little bit later. But I am going against the grain here, and I think I believe that I'm right because of the way that and I don't mean that in a smug way. It's just because of the way that the play was received and promoted in the Communist Party press in France. It was promoted as a Stalinist work, as a doctrinal work, and the party. When one is familiar with the way the party advocates things in their press, there's no deviation from the party line, especially in the official publications. So they would not have promoted it if the text was not intended to be a Stalinist work. The discursive arc of the play is that Robespierre is a martyr who has been put in the position of having to behave in problematic ways because he is so determined to sacrifice himself and his own, his friends, and including Danton, to sacrifice them for a revolutionary ideal. And so while Robespierre and his allies may be engaged and are indeed engaged in things that are not so great, in the play, Robespierre's enemies are engaged in absolute perfidy. They are never, there's never any room to interpret them in a positive way. So again, like I said, it's a way of referencing the contradictions in Soviet politics, but it's a way of ultimately justifying them, because Robespierre is seen as the hero. And when he dies, the revolution, like I said earlier, the revolution is over and the Republic dies. And so it's a way of showing that Robespierre is essential to the revolution, just like Stalin is, and Robespierre's commitment to democracy and the will of the people is as profound as Stalin's commitment to democracy and the people. And so this was the equivalence of, and the continuity between Robespierre and Lenin and Stalin was articulated not only in this work. That's the other piece of evidence that I highlight in the chapter. This was done in commemorative texts written by Roland himself, and also in various elements of the party press, where you see at the same time when they were celebrating the French Revolution, and L'Humanité had a you know, an almost daily series on the front page of the paper. It's kind of like, the funny thing about L'Humanité is it's a party line, you know, authoritarian communist journal, but it's also the dream of professors, you know, to have an intellectual newspaper, but they have to be, you know, extremely twisted with their politics. So they promote their vision of historiography. There's an official historiography of the party, and Robespierre is the only person, the only revolutionary figure who appears three times on the front page of the paper in 1939 and is touted as, you know, the greatest man of the French Revolution. So I think to read this play any other way as being, as you know, chiming and being consonant with overall party discourse around Robespierre and what he represents to, and what Stalin, and how Stalin and Lenin, and how, you know, Lenin referred to Robespierre as a Bolshevik avant la lettre, and Stalin was viewed, you know, was promoted and viewed as, and saw himself as, the continuer of Lenin. Stalin, in many ways, is the best Leninist and the most powerful Leninist, and it's something that, you know, the distinction that we make between Leninism and Stalinism is false in many ways, and it's something that Soviet dissidents were very happy to point out in the 1960s and 70s, that it was to make the distinction is meaningless, essentially. So there's a continuity there that Robespierre was tapped, that Roland, it's funny, when I was editing the book, I made that mistake, mixing up Roland's name and Robespierre's. It's a continuity that Roland highlighted and that was in harmony with party discourse and party historiography.
So it's interesting to me that Robespierre, the play, was published in 1939, which was the same year as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Yes, yeah.
How did this agreement affect Roland?
Okay, Roland, so the pact is signed August 23rd, 1939, and it is an absolute moment of complete and total shock, both, you know, across Europe, but especially in France. I mean, I know the French context best, I should say that. So in terms of across the media in France, so I've done a lot of research on the way the pact was received across the entire spectrum of the French party press. And it was, I mean, widespread shock and dismay. And so Roland kept his reaction private, which is interesting. And it's one of the things that I find most disappointing about Roland, is that he was very much against the pact. He made a number of moves to distance himself from the party. He gave up rights to his works in the Soviet Union. He left the Comité France-URSS, which was sort of a friendship society, you know, between France and the USSR. He expressed in his journals just absolute dismay and disappointment and disgust with the fact that Stalin could shake the hands of the executioners of liberty, because there's that famous picture of Stalin that was circulated widely in the French press, of Stalin shaking hands with von Ribbentrop, who's, you know, Hitler's foreign minister. So Roland kept his reaction private. The sole thing that you see in public is that Roland writes a public letter to the French prime minister saying that he stands with democracy. Okay. And so that in many ways was a double gesture on the part of Roland. And again, another disappointing one, because it allowed him wiggle room to say that he was not criticizing the Soviet Union, because within party circles, the Soviet Union was always held up as a paragon for democracy. And so he kept it quiet. And then so during the Nazi occupation period, his, you know, he keeps voluminous journals, as he always did. But by 1934, and so this is after Stalingrad, after, you know, the Soviet Union ends up being on the right side against the Nazis, Rolland goes back to the party fold. He gets seduced again. They make a huge effort to bring him back and as a friend of the Soviet Union. And they try to, after his death, you know, there's the, well, at his funeral, they fly a hammer and sickle flag above his coffin. And after his death, Aragon, who now takes the baton as the primary French intellectual affiliate with the party, begins a campaign to get Rolland into the Pantheon, which fails. And so one of the reasons that some of his biographers think that Rolland was reluctant to criticize the Soviet Union is because his stepson was in Moscow at the time, and he didn't want to put his life at risk. And one, of course, can understand that. But again, that's conjecture. And I mean, it's to some extent, I mean, you know, there's the way that he described it. And if Rolland is going to be a public intellectual and be, you know, loyal to certain ideals, one would hope that he would be able to transcend his own personal situation, but he did not. And, you know, one can judge him or not for that. I mean, it's hard. Rolland is the person in this book that I have the most empathy for, I have to say.
I would like to talk about André Gide as a counterexample, because he, like many other intellectuals, took these Potemkin visits and came home to renounce their support for the Soviet Union and for Stalin. And Gide, as you write, wrote a travelogue based on his trip, and he was vilified by the party press. And so what sets Gide apart? How do you explain the discrepancy between his writings and Barbusse and Rolland?
So Gide's book is published. And in many ways, the thing that's interesting is that, of course, everyone is writing within the same context here. And in France in the 1920s and 30s, there are some 200 travelogues published, Soviet travelogues published in France, you know, documenting what one sees as the truth of the Soviet experiment. And so this was highly polarized. So either the Soviet Union is a utopia or it's hell on earth and it's, you know, not represent, it's a betrayal of revolutionary and socialist ideals. Okay. There's not a whole lot of room in the middle. And so Rolland and Barbusse effectively end up being paragons of the side of, you know, that the Soviet Union is a utopia. Gide, Gide was never a member of the PCF, but he was one of the affiliated intellectuals. And it's interesting to note, and this is another thing that one learns when one delves into the party press, to see the things that they end up, the writers, how they promote various writers. And one of Gide's famous works, Les Caves du Vatican, was serialized in L'Humanité. And they're very careful. They were very careful with the works and the writers that they serialized. So they liked Gide. Gide liked them. Gide, at one point in 1932, said that he would give up his life for the Soviet Union to succeed. So he's a high degree of passion. He wrote that in his journals. So Gide, in 1936, makes a trip to the Soviet Union, and they try to make it a Potemkin visit. And he ends up really not wanting to be minded on the visit. They had minders, you know, watching, making sure that the people would only see certain things. They had a special train car. They had to get special permission to get the separating doors removed so they could sort of see how real people lived. They take him on visits to, you know, public theaters, and kindergartens, and factories. He ends up sort of trying to escape that bubble that they put him in. And he ends up documenting, in fact, what he saw is that there's a great deal of poverty, that there's that goods and food are in severe shortage, that capitalism ends up, in spite of his own anti-capitalism, capitalism is, he deems better for, he says, is better for diversity and quality of products. He's suspicious of the statistics that are given to him. He notices inequality among the collective farms. He notices that there's a high degree of conformity, intellectual and otherwise, in the Soviet Union. He sees the people as being kept in ignorance around what's going on outside the Soviet Union. They think everything outside the Soviet Union is horrible. And, you know, like they're the only places that have functioning schools and things like that. He also sees signs of a nascent petite bourgeoisie. So signs that are disturbing him. And he also happens to witness the cult of personality around Stalin. He's disturbed that his image is everywhere, that every room has its portrait of him, where the icon used to be, the religious icon, that people have to refer to him in obsequious terms, like he is the, you know, instead of just saying you, people would have to say you, you know, leader of all workers, leader of peoples, master of peoples. He calls Stalin a dictator. And so he gives an honest account. And what he says, and this is what I think is so interesting in the, because I'm fascinated by testimony as a genre. And he says early on in the text that it's that people who are witnessing testimonies are not, or who are writing testimonies are not serving the Soviet Union by only expressing their love for the Soviet Union. And he says that it's too often in this polarized environment with all these travelogues being published, too often the truth of the Soviet Union is said with hate and love of the Soviet Union, and lies around the Soviet Union are said with love. And so he wants to give an honest, as he sees it, depiction of how life is in the Soviet Union, and to give tough love and to hope that his critiques can help it reform itself. But he writes what ends up being a seismic text in this context. And then he's banned, you know, from the party. He's vilified. Romain Rolland writes a response. The book is criticized, you know, as superficial and false and shallow, and then Gide writes a follow-up book, and this one is much less well known, called Retouche à mon retour de l'URSS, which translates roughly as either afterthoughts or amendments to my book, my return from the USSR. And in that book he rebuts directly people who he deemed were lying about the Soviet Union, and he singles out in particular Romain Rolland and Barbusse, despite the fact that Barbusse had been dead already for 2 years, but he decides to single him out anyway. So that shows again how important Barbusse was, even after his death. Outside the party, he was still seen as somebody who had to be reckoned with. And he references, and this I referenced earlier, the fact that people could get rich in the Soviet Union. They'd have to, you know, all the money is paid in rubles, which was not exchangeable. So, you know, you could be rich in rubles and sell, you know, 400,000 of your books, which he was told, by the way, Gide, in the Soviet Union. One of Eluard's collections of poetry sold 10,000 copies in 1 hour. You know, there was a financial aspect to this that I think I don't want to exaggerate, and I don't want to make it simplify it either, because it was much, that was part of it, without question.
So I wish we had enough time to talk about Louis Aragon, Paul Eluard, because they're fascinating figures. But what I would like to do is end on contemporary politics. And your book helps us understand how these writers, intellectuals, politicians, how they promote authoritarian tactics and regimes and movements. And unfortunately, your analysis is still relevant in the 21st century.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about recent developments in global politics?
Unfortunately, like you said, we're in a phase where illiberal politics, both in the West and the former Eastern Bloc, are experiencing a resurgence. And obviously the most disappointing, at least for me, is the fact that the United States isn't in a position where it's defending democracy, which it is, it's at least in the 20th century, was its traditional role. But so Marine Le Pen in the now what's called the Rassemblement National, they changed their name from the Front National, in many ways is in the same authoritarian and Russian philo-Putin orbit as Donald Trump. And so they were, before, when she was trying to become elected president, and we're incredibly lucky for the survival of the EU, for at least for the moment, that Macron won that election, and that she's been relegated to an opposition, although a very vocal and prominent one. And there's this, you know, this new Putin-directed anti-democratic, anti-West, anti-EU, anti-NATO impulse that's surfacing both in France and the United States and elsewhere. You have it in Poland, you have it in Hungary, you have it, and it's incredibly, it's still disturbing, the fact that things took this turn, especially in the United States. So in the French context, you have, and this was the first inkling that I got of it in the French context, because I've been following, I discovered Sputnik, which is the web internet news agency, which is Kremlin directed, just like Russia Today. It's a propaganda organ, and I had been following, because I had had a, the, I just I They don't do it anymore, and for good reason. But I had Google News alerts set up for a few keywords, among them Stalin and Stalinism, both in French and in English. And so all of a sudden, I was getting into my feed these things from Sputnik, both in French and in English. And I started digging around, and it turns out they end up promoting Stalinist rhetoric and Stalinist visions of history, the Stalinist interpretation of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And so, and among other things. And alongside that, they're promoting, Marine Le Pen and Donald Trump and other things. And they're also minimizing the gulag. And so there were signs before the 2016 election that this was happening. It's, in retrospect, it seems clear as day, but I saw signs of it before all this came to a head on an international level. And unfortunately, we don't see any sign of it abating right now, because the disinformation campaigns that we've seen the Russians did indeed try to do the same thing to Macron that they did to Hillary Clinton, but the Macron campaign was much smarter in dealing with them. They planted false documents among their real documents that ended up getting hacked. So they could tell they could tell what had been hacked, and they knew when the fake stuff came out that they were indeed being targeted. So, it's unfortunately Stalin has seen a rehabilitation in contemporary Russia as Putin has consolidated his power and has become more authoritarian. And indeed, in public opinion polls in Russia, Stalin has seen a steady rise since the early 2000s. And he's affiliated most of all with his role as in the Great Patriotic War, in World War II, and defending the fatherland. And so there's increasing government-sponsored fabrication of busts, staging socialist realist art exhibits. Stalin's depicted as Generalissimo, and Putin in many ways has adopted some of the aspects of the Stalin cult by being, a man of nature, somebody who's connected with the people, someone who incarnates state power. Now, there you go.
I feel like there's such a sense of urgency to your book, given the situation that we find ourselves in today. It's a fascinating study. Thanks. And I hope everyone checks it out.
So, thank you.
Andrew, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure, and I'm delighted to be able to be given the opportunity. Thank you.
Sure. We've been talking with Andrew Sobinet about his new book, Generation Stalin: French Writers, the Fatherland, and the Cult of Personality. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.